breakdown of international commitments, how they shape the security calculus of Lebanese actors, and whether guarantors of the ceasefire can still be trusted to enforce peace. Let us begin with a report.
A mass funeral was held on Monday in Beirut's southern suburbs for Hezbollah commander Haitham al-Tabatabai and two of his companions who were killed in an Israeli airstrike a day earlier. Head of Hezbollah Executive Council Sheikh Ali Damush addressed the crowd, praising al-Tabatabai for his great contributions to Hezbollah's achievements. Sheikh Damush said Hezbollah will become stronger with the assassination of its leaders, stressing that Israel will not achieve its goals.
It is the state's duty to protect its citizens and sovereignty. The Lebanese government needs to develop plans for how it will restore the country's sovereignty. All the concessions made so far by the government on the monopoly of arms and accepting U.S. proposals have produced no tangible results. Today, the Israeli enemy is violating all of Lebanon in an attempt to force us to surrender, but we will never give in.
Observers say the concessions made by the Lebanese government have emboldened Israel to disregard the ceasefire agreement that came into force a year ago.
This is Zionist aggression blessed and supported by the U.S., specifically President Trump. This aggression is the responsibility of the Lebanese government and of all those counting on some form of U.S. mediation to secure an Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. This enemy will not withdraw through diplomacy or negotiations. The only strategic option we have is to reestablish the golden equation, a strategy of national security which includes the people, the army, and the resistance.
The crowds attending the funeral in Beirut emphasize that they will continue to support Hezbollah.
Eventually, we will retaliate, and we will never back down. Young or old, it makes no difference to us, since we will remain on this path, and we are all ready to sacrifice our lives. No matter how many people Israel kills and how many houses it destroys, we will always support the resistance movement.
We are here to give our condolences to the family of the martyrs who have given us dignity. They have sacrificed their lives to protect us, and we also are ready to be martyrs like them.
Hezbollah said that Tabatabai played a major role in Lebanon's liberation from Israeli occupation in the year 2000, as well as in fighting Takfiri militants in Syria and Lebanon. That made him a primary target for Israel and the United States.
Haitham Tabatabai was one of the few young men who founded the grassroots movement, later known as Hezbollah. Today, he is remembered as a military commander of the resistance movement, who played an outstanding role in operations against Israeli and Takfiri terrorism for some three decades. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Ali Rezk, security and political analyst, joining us from Beirut. And Batul Sobeiti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Very good to have you on the programme. I'm going to start the conversation with Ali. I'm going to start with the assassination of Hezbollah's chief of staff yesterday. What do you think is going to be the direct consequences of that? Is it going to instill a new level of fear within the organisation, or is it going to, and their supporters, or do you believe that it is going to actually strengthen the resolve for retaliation?
I think that this is not going to lead to a major escalation on Hezbollah's part, at least not in the foreseeable future. I think that Hezbollah's intent not to give Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu what he wants, Benjamin Netanyahu, domestically speaking, at the domestic Israeli political level, I think he's looking for another war after the end of the war on Gaza. Before that, you had also the end of the war in Lebanon. I'm talking, of course, theoretically, both in Gaza and Lebanon, the bombings continue, but it's not the full-scale war which we had witnessed before. So I think that, again, Hezbollah is not going to issue a kind of action or go ahead with a kind of action that would lead to all-out war. I think the Israelis, quite likely, they are going to try and continue with assassination attempts. And this, by the way, was anticipated. I think that many people were expecting that Israel was going to escalate. The big question was how. Will it resort to full-scale warfare? Will it resort to assassinations? Now it appears to be in the assassination phase. And again, I think that this kind of security intelligence war, what I mean by that, assassination operations, I think this is going to continue, especially that Israel believes it enjoys the advantage. Now, quickly regarding what you mentioned in your question about how this will impact Hezbollah, I think you were talking about the popularity or the resolve. I think it's safe to say that Hezbollah's resolve will only increase the fact that it, or the commitment not to disarm, will also increase, its determination will increase. And I think that the Lebanese state is the one in the most difficult position with these kinds of Israeli operations, because the Lebanese state has been saying, you want us to plan to disarm Hezbollah, but you keep attacking Hezbollah. And so this places the state in a very difficult corner.
Right, very good. We're going to talk about the reactions of the Lebanese state about this. But let me continue with another question regarding this latest act of terrorism by Israel. Batul, do you believe that the martyrdom of Haitham is going to weaken as well as military command? And what makes the Israelis believe that it might have such effect, given the successful structure of Hezbollah in resilience and succession planning, usually?
Thank you, and to you again. I'd start by which leaders are.
Well, I believe the connection with Batul might need to be restored because I cannot hear you. Can you try again answering the question? Because I could not hear you at all. All right, Ali, would you please continue with answering the question?
I think you have to look at what the objectives were. Was the Israeli objective to weaken Hezbollah, to weaken its morale? Was it something else? Was it about Netanyahu's own domestic political calculations? Because Netanyahu has been promoting this. The Israelis have been highlighting that this is the number two in Hezbollah. So it's as if they're trying to promote such a dramatic achievement being made. So that's, you have to bear in mind that that's one of the Israeli aims, meaning that Netanyahu can use this domestically at an Israeli domestic political level. As you said, the Israelis have assassinated leader after leader of Hezbollah, Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, Sheikh Raghib Harab, in addition to Haj Imad Mughniyeh. Of course, the most recent and the biggest loss was Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, which was about 1 year ago. Basically, the Israelis think that they can achieve, or this is what Israelis are good at. When it comes to ground infantry fighting, I think that the Israelis have been dealt severe blows before. But in terms of this kind of warfare, the security intelligence warfare, we have to admit that they do enjoy an upper hand, and that's why they're resorting to these kinds of methods. Now, how successful are they going to be? That's a different story. If you look at the history of assassinations, the history of assassinations hasn't done much in terms of weakening Hezbollah. Now, after the assassination of Sayyid Hassan, has this weakened movement or not? It's too early to tell, but I will say this. I think that due to the special status which Sayyid Hassan enjoyed, I think that even those people who weren't with Hezbollah but were supportive or sympathetic to the movement are now going to flock to its ranks merely out of that passion for Sayyid Hassan. So I think that in the longer term, this step taken by Israel may indeed backfire in terms of how it will influence or impact Hezbollah.
Right, Batul, I'm glad that you're back, hopefully. So regardless of the objective of the Israelis, what do you think will be the reaction of Hezbollah? Do you believe it's going to be immediate retaliation, as we know that the Israeli air defense is on high alert right now? What do you think it is going to be, more of a reserved manner?
Yes, the Islamic Resistance of Lebanon is adhering to the decision to remove the weapons south of the Lifani River out of commitment to the state and what was agreed on November the 27th, not because it believes that the other side is right. Since the other side has not adhered to this ceasefire agreement at all, the resistance has the unreserved right not to adhere to it either. The agreement is considered void because the other side has not respected it. So here is where the equation emerges. If the erosion inflicted by Israel to the resistance is less than the rate of the resistance's growth and restoration of its capabilities, then I believe that strategic patience ensures a general policy of continued growth despite the enemy's expansionist ambitions. When it becomes completely clear that this enemy does not restrain itself and continues all forms of violation, then responding becomes necessary because it commits these violations even without being responded to, justifying them with various excuses such as, you know, claiming that the resistance is growing. But if the pace of the strikes against the resistance increases to the point where the losses and the erosion exceed the growth and the recuperation, then I believe that's where we might see the equation change and the resistance may decide to respond in whatever manner it deems appropriate. And at that point, we could expect a more open war. The resistance, of course, has never initiated a war. Its actions have always been a response to wars imposed on it. These are defensive wars, and of course, defensive wars, it goes without saying, are fully justified. Sometimes when the enemy's strikes cause damage and destruction, the resistance may choose to delay, postpone, or withdraw. It must be said that this is not out of weakness, but in preparation for a phase in which it can establish a deterrent equation within what it calls strategic balance. So I want to emphasize that the matter is not the resistance retaliating for each attack, because we are currently at one stop and one pit in a long battle that is not linked to any individual. And just on the question that you asked me previously that I couldn't respond to, I would say that the battle in which the leaders are killed fighting is a successful one, because the morale and the spirit that this gives the resistance fighters on the ground multiplies, and for the surrounding support of the resistance,
right.
The resistance believes that sacrifices are the required price. That's how they know that liberation is on its way, as long as blood is being given. And the resistance has proven again and again that the killing of its leaders strengthens their movement. And never at any point in time was the resistance able to recruit the number of fighters and supporters that it is able to, as it has now. Whether in Lebanon or in Gaza, many more times than it was able to previously. And this is due to the exposure and the unveiling of the enemy to such an extent that the resistance is no longer now a luxury option, but rather an obligatory choice for those who did not previously believe in this.
Right, Ali, I want to talk about the mechanisms of this ceasefire, the so-called ceasefire. Of course, I'm not sure if you can call it a ceasefire when more than 10,000 violations have occurred. Tell me about what do you think these so many ceasefire violations tell about the credibility of the guarantors of this ceasefire?
Well, look, everybody knows that the United States is not a neutral mediator, that it sides with the Israelis. And you've heard what the American envoys have said. Clearly, they're saying that Israel has a right to defend itself. It decides when to attack. Even regarding this assassination of Haitham Toptabai, they said that Israel behaves as a sovereign nation, and it decides how to defend its own security. So it's no secret that the United States sides with the Israelis, even often at the expense of American interests, in my humble opinion. But I think that ultimately what the Israeli goal is to have something which is similar to Syria take place in Lebanon. I am sure you saw the tour which Benjamin Netanyahu made to southern Syria, where he was accompanied by a number of Israeli senior officials. And they've been violating Syrian territory. They want to expand. In fact, they are expanding into Syria. And they want something similar to play out in Lebanon. Now, what prevents them from pursuing something similar in Lebanon is Hezbollah, despite the fact that it was dealt some very, very heavy, unprecedented blows. Hezbollah remains a force to be reckoned with, particularly if the opposing side wants to occupy territory. So that's the Israeli goal, to try and overcome or to remove this Hezbollah obstacle, which poses an obstacle to further expansion, which is part of the Zionist ideology of the Greater Israel, which includes Syria, other places. Now, the issue which is somewhat, not very surprising, but I think not consistent with American interests, is that the Americans are allowing them to do this. And again, I'm not sure that this serves American interests when America wants to establish itself as an influential player It has an ally in Lebanese President Joseph Aoun. And these Israeli actions all undermine this. I don't think that it's in U.S. interest to have failed states in Syria and in Lebanon. It's in Israeli interests, and the Americans appear in one or another to be following the Israeli truck or to be following the Israeli line, so to speak.
Right, Bethel, I want to talk about the effects of these violations on Lebanese civilians and the population, general population in Lebanon. Do you believe these violations have changed their perception of security?
Yes, the resistance wants to cultivate a general consensus amongst Lebanese nationals that the issue is with the occupation and not the resistance weapons. These weapons are what deters the entity from occupying Lebanon entirely. And when this belief becomes cemented, then you'll get Lebanese society calling for increased protection of the resistance as this essential credit in liberation. Of course, it needs to be said that Lebanon is a special case compared to other resistance fronts, in that each front has its own conditions, circumstances, and methods of resistance. In Lebanon, the resistance represents a portion of the population, and many parties are not a part of the resistance. You have a large segment in Lebanon that does not believe in the resistance option or even conspires against it. The resistance takes this into account and seeks to maintain a degree of majority support, since achieving consensus in this domain is very difficult. But when the needs of the resistance becomes a national necessity because of the enemy's violations, the internal atmosphere becomes ideal for coordinating resistance action and creating deterrence, meaning forming a comprehensive national deterrent balance. Until now, there are still voices within Lebanon, mostly from the Christian parties, you could say, calling for the disarmament of the resistance. But when popular demands shift and express themselves in the streets, calling for the necessity of responding, then the response becomes a popular demand rather than a unilateral decision by one party dragging the country into war, which is what the resistance aims to avoid.
Right. One final question for Ali before continuing the conversation with Batul. Ali, do you think that the issue of disarmament, of course, how do you think this is going to change dynamics regarding the pressure from the Lebanese government on the issue of disarmament by Hezbollah?
I think that obviously this is going to make Hezbollah more committed to preserving its arms. Remember that Hezbollah also has a large segment of supporters in Lebanon, and these supporters, even if we were to assume that Hezbollah was ready to make concessions in terms of its weapons, its supporters wouldn't accept that. So I think that it's safe to say that this issue has been shelved. Now, the Lebanese government, the Lebanese state, how it's going to behave, I think that you have a split in the Lebanese, amongst the Lebanese state officials. The Lebanese Prime Minister, Nawab Salam, he's enthusiastic for disarmament. The Lebanese President, Joseph Aoun, has called for a more calculated approach, one which focuses on dialogue. Again, as I said in my earlier answer, the Lebanese state is the one which is in the most difficult situation right now as a result of the Israeli actions. I think that it depends on how much the Lebanese state bows down to American pressures, or, on the other hand, how it takes a firm stance. Up until now, the Lebanese army in particular has been very committed not to enter into a kind of confrontation with Hezbollah in order to forcefully disarm the group.
Right. Well, let me continue the conversation. Thank you so much, Ali. I'm going to continue the conversation with Batul now. Regarding the role of the U.S. in the ceasefire and the aftermath, can you tell me, as the architect and the enforcer of this ceasefire, the Americans insisted that this time, unlike any other ceasefire, we are going to be very, very exact on and watchful for probable violations with immediate responses. But what do you think the path that they will likely take will be? Are they going to stand up to an ally, or are they going to just look the other way?
I think the path is the status quo. The guarantors of the ceasefire, you know, the US, France, they play absolutely no role. They, in the sense that they allow Israel to do whatever it wants without opposing. I mean, even worse, we saw Tom Barak when he came to Lebanon. He said it clearly and in one word. We cannot and do not wish to pressure Israel. It's intentional. Same words of Lindsey Graham. It's that all Lebanon, all the state has to care about is disarmament, and don't even ask if Israel's going to attack or not attack after the disarmament process. So there's not even guarantees being given by America that if the disarmament occurs, that Israel will stop attacking, meaning that the occupation will resume. So, of course, these measures that you're mentioning, they mean nothing because there's been zero adherence. and actually the opposite. The US backs and justifies everything Israel does. Worse than that, what Israel does is used as a pressure. So the Israeli attacks on Lebanon is used as a pressure against Lebanon to do what Israel failed to do during the 66-day war, which is to disarm the resistance. Whilst we know that the resistance has adhered to its side of the agreement that has been, giving the weapons south of the Litani. Of course, the Lebanese state can say yes or no to the Americans who come with the demands of the Israeli entity. And your esteemed guest has made it clear that the Lebanese army has stayed committed, that it does not want to enter into this kind of a civil war. Yes, the decision to submit or to comply with American demands is therefore in the hands of the state. If the state satisfies American demands at the expense of sovereignty and independence, then that is capitulation and submission, as Tom Barak himself put it. The UN in its previous resolutions were not fulfilled, and this one also do not expect it to be fulfilled. This is the reality of institutions like the UN. Whatever Israel does in serving its expansionism is completely allowed.
Right, and in about 45 seconds, please tell me, do you believe escalation is inevitable now, or can diplomacy and deterrence still prevent a war?
I do believe that there is deterrence. I mean, we've reached the peak of escalation, but the resistance ultimately is preparing for the next war. This phase is about closing wars, not opening new ones, I believe. So I don't believe that we're likely to see an open war as we did in September last year. Why? Very simply, because there's no interest on either side for this to be an expanded war. Israel is at its optimum position where it can strike without receiving a direct response from the resistance. And as we know, Israel is trying to strike the existing capabilities of the resistance in a sequential manner. And the resistance is very busy rebuilding itself, closing its gaps, making uses of the lessons learnt from the war last year. And also, it is Israeli admission that the Lebanese resistance has continued, reinforcing its positions deep inside Lebanon, building its fortified sites, and expanding its military infrastructure that remains untouched by Israel's constant bombardment.
Right, thank you so much indeed, Batul, for your opinions and for your insight into the matter. I would like to once again thank Ali Resk, security and political analyst, joining us from Beirut, and Batul Sobeiti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Now, a ceasefire is not a suggestion, it is a binding commitment. If Israeli violations go unanswered, then the very idea of peace becomes an illusion. To preserve credibility and justice, the world must demand accountability, because without enforcement, ceasefires are nothing more than broken promises. Thank you so much for staying with us on another Spotlight. I am Bahman Ray.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
fact. Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Emimet is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. Surah Al-Qadr was also revealed in Mecca, like the other Meccan surahs. It is short and rhythmic. There are also narrations concerning Surah Al-Qadr itself, stating that if someone recites Surah Al-Qadr 7 times over the graves of the believers, God will grant forgiveness to both the deceased and the person who recited the chapter. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. In His name, for existence is from Him. He is the source of all types of mercy. In His name means seeking help from all His attributes. Seeking help from Allah, which signifies all God's attributes, not just As-Samad, the eternal refuge, or Al-Qadir, all-powerful, or Al-Hay, the ever-living, or Al-Ghayyum, the self-subsisting. Allah encompasses all, like the word liquid, which include all liquids. It does not say Bism As-Samad or Bism Al-Qayyum, but rather Bismillah. This is the same that comprises all of God's attributes. I seek help from all His attributes. He is the source of all mercy. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Life as you know, you reap what you sow, and when you do good, Allah will protect you and stop you falling down. Allah, we surrender, 'cause He knows all, no compromise. Hears your laugh and feels your cry, He is there all the time.
Hello and welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi, and I continue to be joined by independent British journalist Sarah Wilkinson. Sarah is a long-standing campaigner for Palestinian liberation. Sarah, in part one of the programme, we spoke about the repression that you faced from the British state for your journalism on Palestine, and we were talking about the way in which the police operate here in Britain. We know that they're an arm of the state, but they're supposed to be operationally independent. But it seems that now they're not even operationally independent, right? There's just this pipeline of demands coming from the regime in Tel Aviv to the British government and then passed on to the police. And then this goes to a question that seems to rile up a lot of people, but which I think is very important, which is, who exactly is driving this push to silence pro-Palestine voices in Britain? I have my own view on that. Some people say that it just comes directly and organically from the British state, which supports Israel because it's simply a Western colonial outpost. But I think that oversimplifies the question, because we saw, particularly under Jeremy Corbyn when he was leader of the Labour Party, how the Israel lobby in Britain intensified and battle-tested new censorship methods to go after pro-Palestine voices in Britain. And that came from the Zionist entity. It didn't come from Britain. We saw how the former Israel ambassador to Britain, Mark Regev, worked to push these strategies. That's when we had the widespread rollout of an official definition of anti-Semitism with the IHRA working definition. We had the revival of a group like the Jewish Labour Movement to help take down Jeremy Corbyn. We saw the case of Shai Massot, the Zionist spy, working to take down even a conservative minister, Sir Alan Duncan. And it seems to me that the British state has been, over the past decade especially, increasingly captured and radicalized by the Zionist regime. And would you agree with that assessment, which is basically that the scale of the push against pro-Palestine journalists, activists and protesters here in Britain is primarily being pushed by external forces? And what's your take on that?
I was waiting for you to say occupied. Are we occupied? And yes, we are. Everything's coming straight out of the Tel Aviv playbook. Even the questions in interrogations, they're no longer following British protocol. You know, some of my interrogation questions were just outright racist. I think one of them, you know, why do you think Palestinian people are better than white people? I mean, I just find that an astonishing question. And it's clearly not a British question. So are we occupied? Yes, indeed. I think that we are very much so. So although, yes, it seems to be coming from the British government, you know, like, it's not just that we're allies, because as I've said before, who would have an ally that murders and maims? Well, yeah, the numbers are 70,000, but, you know, we know that even if you look at the Lancet, you know, they were guessing the figures were over 200,000 Palestinians killed. I know that there's 15 or 16,000 Palestinian children missing, so on top of nearly 30,000 killed, there's hundreds of thousands of adults and children missing. So who'd have an ally that is murdering at this extent? Who would actually brag about having the same values as an entity that is basically using mass murder to ethnically cleanse an entire population? Who'd do that? And I can't believe that the British public aren't more shocked that even when you hear Ursula von der Leyen and talking about, well, we have, you know, similar values. It's, well, no, we don't. I don't know anyone who has the same value as a regime that is prepared to annihilate an entire population. And that annihilation is still going on. Let's not forget this yellow line that they've created. They're now, this morning, they've announced that they're moving the yellow line outwards to take more of Gaza's territory. And that yellow line obviously has about another 250 meters in front of it, where suddenly these yellow blocks appear. And let's not forget, it isn't a spray-painted yellow line. It's an invisible yellow line, and it's an excuse to continue the genocide, to continue killing innocent Palestinians, young children playing football, just who accidentally cross over this invisible line. The genocide, the ceasefire, they're one and the same. The ceasefire is just, I think I've used this phrase before, but it's a rebranded version of genocide. And I've also used the phrase of you know, this is a Rubik's cube of genocide. So we're not just talking about starvation and disease. We're not talking about, you know, destroying the hospitals and the infrastructure, the sewage, creating a situation where hepatitis becomes rife and then there are no medications, the polio virus, you know, the bad weather, the fact that the pipelines are all destroyed. If you look at everything that the Israelis have done and are doing, then it becomes this Rubik's cube of genocide. It may not look the same every day, but it will still be a combination. And so, you know, even with this, am I going to call it a peace plan? No, it's a genocide plan that has been manufactured by the Israelis and the Americans, which they've also called, was it a board of peace? Oh, they're all such lovely words, aren't they? And a stabilization force to enable them to continue the genocide, but using these very lovely words. And it means that they can make the public relax. Oh, how do you feel now the war is over? I can't tell you how many times that has been said to me. And I've had to say, it's not over. The genocide never finished. It's continuing. It's going on. But it's just got nicer words around it, so people think that it's finished. People, I mean, was it 29 people killed this morning? Dozens of children. And then 25 people killed yesterday. These are airstrikes. It's continuing to bomb Gaza. So I don't know where the ceasefire fits into that, because as far as I'm concerned, that isn't a ceasefire. They're not stopping anything. They're continuing with the ethnic cleansing by death, or even by trying to bust them out and then fly them into South Africa. I'm glad South Africa has now put a stop to it. May get some criticism for it. But the point is, it didn't want to be a party to ethnic cleansing. And that's what we're all complicit with. If we don't speak out as journalists, if we don't speak out as reporters and activists, if we don't keep telling the world this, they actually do sit back as if they were just watching an episode of Coronation Street and think it's all over. And the thing is, it isn't. We're halfway through. The ethnic cleansing isn't complete, and they will continue until it is complete. I may have strayed off your question a little bit. It's because there's so much of it, and it's because I think the general public have been conned. They've been conned by words, and I'd like to think they're a little bit more intelligent than that. It's disappearing out of mainstream media, certainly. And people keep saying now the war is over all the time. And for a start off, it was never a war. It was a genocide. And now we have this Trump-Netanyahu genocide plan, which is against the Geneva Conventions, which is against the Apartheid Conventions. It's against the Genocide Convention. And, yeah, I kind of want people to wake up.
Well, let's turn now to those ongoing developments. So, of course, you're talking about the recent UN Security Council resolution, which is this Western-imposed colonial trusteeship, or a mandate, if you will, that seeks to dissolve Palestinian governance in Gaza, hand temporary administration of the land. Well, they say temporary, but I think they mean permanent administration of the land. So the same powers that armed Israel's genocide, to disarm the occupied people, or attempt to disarm them. I don't think they'll be very successful in doing that, while also throwing Palestinian statehood to the wind. I mean, what's your reading beyond what you've just said on what that signals about the future?
I think, isn't that what they always wanted? This was always the plan, you know, to dissolve Palestinian statehood, to prevent the Palestinians' right of return, which is an inalienable right, by the way, to, you know, not to have to pay reparation costs, to create a situation where Gaza is uninhabitable, to then, say, use voluntary migration, which is enforced migration, to get them out there, to continue killing, to find a way to continue the genocide, but under a different form. Isn't that what they were always doing? I can't actually see the difference. This is exactly the same, but it's got some very pretty words around it. And now somebody's gone and voted. And I think the United Nations Security Council, oh my God, how spineless do they have to be? I don't know whether I was the only one praying for Russia and China to veto it, but no, it was worse than that. They abstained, which is like, we might have vetoed it, but we decided that we'd do a trade and stay and just stay quiet. I mean, it's even worse. So, you know, you're waiting for somebody to stand up and say, this can't go on. This plan is just about legitimizing genocide. It's about taking away accountability. And it's about allowing the Israelis to take Gaza over. Well, isn't that what they were always trying to do? Isn't that what they were doing when they were bombing it? And they are still bombing it. But isn't that what they did when they originally invaded it? Isn't that what has been happening for 77 years? I can't see how this plan is different from the illegal occupation. And as you rightly said, you know, occupations are supposed to be temporary. Here we have a permanent one. We have dozens of violations of international law just inside this. Oh, I'm going to keep calling it a peace plan, and I really don't want to. Just inside this Trump-Netanyahu genocide plan are multiple violations of not just the Geneva Convention, but, you know, international law itself, multiple violations. It is disabling the Palestinians, the right to self-governance. There's nothing in this plan which is aimed at giving the Palestinians what they've always wanted and always resisted for, which is self-determination, which is the chance to actually belong to their own land and own their own land and govern their own land in their own way. No matter who they vote for, you know, it's removing their ability to continue living there. Well, isn't that what they were doing in the first place? This is just a different side of the Rubik's Cube. And it's a clever one because, you know, there are people that think, oh, you know, Trump's a hero. You know, he's come along and he's going to make peace. He hasn't made peace. You know, if 29 Palestinian people are slaughtered in one morning and then the day before another 25 and 13 children the day before. I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure where that is peace. I'm not quite sure if you want to call that an incremental genocide because the numbers are smaller. Well, you know, eventually you will carry on and you'll have an entire genocide. Nothing has changed. I was even thinking about the Colombian peace plan when I read it. You know, everything was good until they said, you know, but of course, you know, we would like the Israelis to continue being able to have Jerusalem as their capital. Okay, so previous to that, they had stated that they had to withdraw back to the 1948 lines and, you know, they had to pull out and then no more settlements. And then they say, oh, but you can still have Jerusalem as your capital. So how in God's name do you do that when you've got to ethnically cleanse Jerusalem of the Palestinians? So in some ways it completely contradicted the beginning of what they were trying to say. Theirs was the best plan, but at the end of the day, it's still once again an excuse to continue ethnically cleansing Palestine, central Palestine, Jerusalem. And then, oh, but we'll give you Abu Dhabi, we'll give you East Jerusalem as your capital, which is actually a rubbish dump. Now, I don't mean to insult Abu Dhabi. There are people that live there, and it's their environment, and it's their home, but it's been turned into a rubbish dump. And so that's what's going to become the Palestinian capital when Jerusalem is their capital. I can't see how anything's changed. It's just been relabeled. That's my point of view anyway.
Well, I mean, people talk about the fact that the Nakba never ended, that it's an ongoing Nakba. And it seems to me, quite rightly, as you've pointed out, that it really nothing has changed. All that changes is the pace and also the framing around the genocide. But the genocide always continues. And, of course, that was always the Zionist plan. Even if you look at the so-called Labour Zionists, who were the majority back then and sort of considered the more moderate wing of Zionism, not that there is any such thing. But David Ben-Gurion and the Labour Zionists, who, of course, were the people who created the Haganah, which then became the Israel Occupation Forces, and which carried out numerous massacres alongside Zionist terrorist organizations during the Nakba. They were very clear right at the beginning that they would only accept a partitioned state so that they could eventually take over the rest of Palestine. And, of course, that comes with, as I think Ben-Gurion said, brutal compulsion and also expulsion of the indigenous people, and not just their expulsion, but also their mass slaughter, of course, as we have seen. You made reference earlier to the Greater Israel Project, which is the Zionist expansionist plan to conquer all of historic Palestine, as well as to absorb parts of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and beyond. In the West, for many years, this has often been treated as some sort of conspiracy theory, but the Zionists talk openly about it, and they talk more openly about it now than they ever have before. And we even saw Netanyahu recently visit some of the newly annexed land, or the newly occupied land, I should say, in Syria. How serious is this Greater Israel plan, and what effects could that have for the region in the coming months and years?
I do hate making predictions because they often come true, but there was a time when it wasn't okay to talk about the Greater Israel Project. People did think, you're right, that you were a conspiracy theorist, but it's absolutely true. And I wonder whether some of our arrests and our trials and our court cases have been perfectly timed around 2027, 2028, and the end of 2026, when you will see a much bigger expansion going on. And that could very likely, when they said they were going to bomb Gaza back to the Stone Ages, well, we're looking at Lebanon could very easily end up in this situation. We've only seen a small taste of it at the moment, and the southern Lebanon is being bombed and people are being killed, and now they're attacking a Palestinian refugee camp. But you know, a lot of Lebanese people as we know, have been slaughtered, and the pager incident. And, you know, I think what we're going to see over the next coming year and towards the end of the year is a real push. The Greater Israel Project is going to actually start to become a reality. And by then it'll be too late. You know, the Israelis have played the better chess game, and we're sitting around just moving pawns around the chessboard. But it's going to happen. And I think Lebanon is a target. I actually think Jordan is a very big target, but I get into trouble for saying it. But I also think Syria, you know, and obviously there's parts of Saudi Arabia that are very much involved in losing their land to the Greater Israel Project, and North Sinai, I think of the two places. And if you look at the Greater Israel Project, that takes the Suez Canal as well. So, you know, I know that the Egyptian people are very supportive of Palestine, so this is not against the Egyptian people, but Sisi is being very careless about one of his main sources of income, and that's not just the tourist industry over the pyramids, but the Suez Canal. Now, if you look at the Greater Israel Project map, that includes the Suez Canal, that includes parts of Saudi Arabia, that includes pretty much most of Lebanon. I don't know what is going to be left of Lebanon. And I think if the countries don't start rising up, and rising up very quickly, you know, it's difficult when you've got America sort of pressing down on you. But, you know, if something isn't done very swiftly, I think that the same time that we are no longer able to post, we are no longer able to work as journalists and reporters. Don't forget that 250, Palestinian journalists have already been slaughtered. But we're also looking at the silencing of hundreds of very big people with very big platforms. That is when I think it will all happen. And this is a preparation. This taking us to court, accusing us of this, accusing us of that, trying to jail the people that have been on YouTube, like Richie Medhurst, you know, trying to jail Craig Murray, trying to jail myself, I suppose, trying to jail anybody who's been outspoken or anybody who's prepared to tell the truth tellers. Then it's all going to happen at that time when we become silent. And this is, you know, I've got I suppose I'm not very positive about all of these court cases, because they do not want people exposing these plans. And how do we expose them? We expose them through social media. It's going to be difficult to stop people. There's a legal reason why they can't stop people using social media. The only way they can silence us is to jail us. And when we are all jailed, that is when you're going to see all of these things start happening, this mad push to start taking more and more territory in Syria, but Lebanon in particular, and Jordan. You know, I feel that Jordan is a holding platter. I mean, there's a lot of Palestinian refugees live there, but, you know, it is also a sovereign country whose king could be forced into exile. The Greater Israel Project is actually one of the most dangerous things that we have ahead of us. And in some ways, the British state is preparing a way. It's preparing a pathway so that it can do it. It knows BBC isn't going to cover it. It knows that the mainstream news is not going to cover it. So it's got to silence all of the people that would cover it. And funnily enough, when you look at all of the names of the people who've been arrested, those are the ones who are most prolific on social media, on Twitter or other platforms, telling the world, wake up, this is happening. Now, they silence all of us. They're just going to quietly get along with it. And I think this is why the dates of the trials are done specifically, because these things are going to start happening by the end of 2026. I would be surprised if you don't see a lot more bombing in Palestine, maybe the destruction of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which I think will make a lot of people gasp. But I do think the collapse of Al-Aqsa Mosque is imminent if they continue their excavations. Maybe all this will happen by the end of 2026, when we've all been silenced and we're unable to report about it. Hopefully somebody will fill in. But at the moment, people are terrified. People are terrified to to take over, if you like, posting 30 to 50 tweets per day. It actually takes up your whole day. It's a full-time job. There isn't really anybody else doing it. So all of those investigative journalists, we're all being silenced. And I think we're being silenced for a reason. And the Greater Israel Project is the reason. And it has begun already. I think Francesca Albanese said it's already begun. And I think she's right. But it hasn't begun on a big enough scale that it's noticeable. And so they're getting away with it. And so, yeah, I do fear the amount of arrests that are being made because they are prolific reporters and activists. And they're the ones that we need to pass on to the next generation. That something big is going down, something bad is happening, and your government is facilitating it. Do something about it. Get out on the streets. There is no ceasefire. This is all a ruse to make you relax. And so, yeah, it's another part of the Rubik's Cube.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to call our conversation to an end. I really appreciate the insights that you've been able to give, Sarah, and I want to express my support and solidarity with you. I want to wish you the very best of luck with your case. And I'd ask anyone who's listening to follow you and also your work if they aren't already doing so. Sarah, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
See you next time.
Good morning to you all. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and we are very happy and is renowned for its philosophical and theoretical scholarship. Algebra from the Arabic Spring of Truth will follow next. And our final program this hour is Kids Corner. The program is all about children and child's play, a fun program specially made for children.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran says the U.S. is not ready for genuine talks over Tehran's peaceful nuclear program and only seeks to dictate its own terms and demands. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns that thousands of internally displaced people in Gaza still lack safe shelter amid cold weather and flooding. Also in our headlines, at least two National Guard members were fatally shot in an attack near the White House as U.S. gun violence continues to claim more lives. Hello and welcome, everybody. The Iranian foreign minister says the U.S. is not genuinely willing to engage in negotiations over Iran's peaceful nuclear program, despite Tehran's readiness for talks. Speaking with France 24 channel in Paris, Abbas Araghchi said Iran has always been ready for negotiations, but the U.S. has not shown real determination to engage in fair and genuine dialogue. He argued that Washington always seeks to dictate